We're going to talk about, my name's Matthew, I'm an alcoholic still. We're going to talk about the fruits of sponsorship. So we had a kind of good segue in there because I got to talk about Mike, my friend Mike. So one of the things I talked about yesterday is that I made reference to the story with Jim. You know, Jim is the guy who has the car dealership. And for some reason, and if there is an alcoholic thinking, I think this is it, he goes out of the city to find somebody to buy a car. Goes to the country where there's fewer people. And remember it says that line, all went well for a while for Jim, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life, right? And so my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is that there's great leaps and bounds when you're new. You know, remember you get your driver's license, you get insurance. I remember the first time I got pulled over when I was happy. Yeah, I'm like, dude, I got it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to jail. And the guy was so like, you're pretty happy about this ticket. And I'm like, oh, different for me.
Yeah.
But you know, after a while, years and years and years of sobriety, it's smaller. It's smaller increments. It's little awakenings inside. And I think that what we're about to talk about is how the 12th step, or sponsoring other men in Alcoholics Anonymous or women, how that continues to enlarge your spiritual life. So I had a sponsee who we call Liver Mike, right? We call him Liver Mike because when he drank, and he repeatedly went out and drank, he would turn bright yellow like a yield sign because his liver was so shot. And I sponsored him for a while. And he ended up in the hospital near my house. Now, some of you have been here for the Friday and Saturday know that I had a family member, my wife, end up in the hospital for 5 weeks. And one of the things that really impressed me was that everybody showed up for my wife. You know, when I wasn't in town, and not only were they putting up my Christmas lights and my Christmas tree, they were visiting her and bringing her food from outside the hospital and asking her about what kind of drugs they were giving her and all sorts of interesting AA men questions to women in the hospital. But so I said to Mike, when he was in an alcoholic coma, dying in the Long Beach hospital, right near my house, less than a mile from my house, I said to Mike, even though I didn't know if he could hear me, I will come visit you every day. And I want to be honest about who I am. I almost immediately regretted saying that. It's like, God, I just said that out loud, you know? So a couple or 3 days later, it's raining in Southern California, which we always look up in the sky and say, what is that? And people don't drive well in the rain in Southern California. No, and in ours, you know, where you guys get more rain, and I live in Seattle, there's oil on the street, right? And when the rain hits it, the street gets slippery, and people just get closer to you in their cars in Southern California. It's a rainy day. I got to go all the way to Pasadena for an appointment I have with some physicians for work, and I'm wearing a good suit, and nothing's going right, right? The guys are being contrary and difficult. They're not listening or responding to the data I'm talking to them about. The rain's bad, and I don't have a raincoat. I just have this nice suit on. People are driving crazy. I'm having what my wife calls a broken shoelace day, where everything is a little bit, you know, everything. So I'm in the car, and I remember I knew I was not in my right mind because Derek and the Dominoes version of Layla came on, and I thought, God, this song is so overrated. So stupid, you know. And it's a masterpiece, right? But that's where my head was. I didn't want to eat. I didn't want to have sex. There was nothing that was going to make me happy. I was in a bad spot. And I'm driving home, going, well, I go home, go in my room, watch TV, and veg out. And then I remembered my promise to Mike. And I was bummed because I didn't want to go to the hospital on my way home from work. I had not seen him that day. And actually, his hospital was between the freeway and my house. It couldn't have been more convenient. But on the way back, I'm like, I got nothing for the guy. And quite frankly, he did this to himself. We did everything we could. You know, I had all this negative stuff in my head. So I pull off the freeway, and I have a really good AA car. I was trying to go to my house, and it drove to the hospital. I got automatic, right? And I parked outside the emergency, the ICU, and I'm looking at the back door, and it's pouring rain. I'm thinking, man, I don't even want to walk from here to there. I got nothing for this guy. And I'm bummed. I don't like my job. And I don't like my life right now. And I walk across into the hospital. I'm soaking wet. And, you know, an ICU and on a rainy day is a pretty grim place. And the nurses are in almost exactly the same mood I'm in. And I come up. And now Mike's whole family died of alcoholism. Really painful, disgusting death from alcohol. And he's got no one. I'm it. So every time I go there, I have to convince them that, yeah, that is true. I am not a family member, but I'm the only thing he's got. And I'm his sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I'm not mistaken, he's here because of liver failure. Do you think I could spend a few minutes? I have to do this every time I go. And then I give him my business card, and they staple it in his chart. So I go, and I do this whole thing with very little enthusiasm to a nurse who has no enthusiasm. And she opens his chart, and there's like six of my business cards. I go, that's me. Here's my business card. So they let me in. Now, when you're in a coma, they don't leave the lights on in the room, right? Why would they? And Mike's a very big guy, and he's strapped in because apparently before he went into the coma, he ran. So he's strapped in. He's got no teeth. His eyes are like slightly parted, and they're red bloodshot because all the blood vessels are breaking in his eyes. He's bright yellow, and he's in a coma. So I sat at the end of his bed, and I looked at my watch, and I said, I'm going to give you 15 minutes, Mike. And I just looked around the room. And I remember looking at his open mouth thinking he told me he didn't like dentists. And I thought, that's a shame. And I mean, this is the kind of thinking, right? I'm not spiritually awake. I'm not praying for Mike. I'm not meditating. I'm just like, okay, it's been 3 minutes. 12 more minutes. That's what it felt like, right? And then at about 13 minutes, I decide that's close enough to 15. And I get up to leave. And I went over just out of curiosity. I stood at the edge of his bed, and I had my hands dangling over the little railing, and I was just looking at him, and he grabbed my hand and sat bolt upright. And I needed to change my pants because he frightened the hell out of me. He was in a coma. And he sat up, and he looked around the room, and he said, am I crazy? Because who knows what he's seeing? He's toxic, right? He can't, who knows what he's saying? And I said, no, man, you're alcoholic. And he looked around the room again, and he looked me right in the eye, and he said, why do you love me so much? And I was embarrassed. I didn't want to go. And I looked at him and said, Mike, because you're just like me. And there was just this light. It wasn't a physical, it wasn't a light that you could see. There was a light in the room. The planets aligned. I was in the perfect place. My shoelaces were miraculously one again. And he just looked around. He looked at me. He fell back. His eyes rolled back in his head. We went back into a coma. And I walked to the door of that hospital. I turned, I looked at him, and I thought, thank God for Liver Mike. And I went to the nurse and I said, is he going to get out of here? And she looked at her shoes. And that's within the HIPAA guidelines, meaning no. He's going to die in here. And that's what they told me every time I asked. And I left. And my wife was more beautiful. And my children were more brilliant. And my world was bigger. I had not failed to enlarge my spiritual life. But I didn't do it with enthusiasm and willingness. And all I really did was bring my body and my distracted brain to a situation where God used me. You know, Mike, I was the best man at Mike's wedding. He lived. He said to me, I had a spiritual experience. I opened up my eyes and I was holding your hands in a hospital. And I said, that's so funny because I had a spiritual experience at exactly that same moment. You know, and all of us have literally dozens of stories like this. That's just one I wanted to tell you because the point is you don't have to always want to go do it. You just have to do it, you know. If I waited for the proper motivation every day, I'd play my guitar all day long, right? But I go out and get to do these things. Now, it's not mechanistic. I did talk to my sponsor, and I'm like, I'm just going to go to hospitals every day and meet dying alcoholics. Because you don't know where you're supposed to go. You know, somebody was asking me in the hallway, you know, I'm self-centered, I'm isolating, what should I do? And, you know, and I talked about Bill Wilson. You know, Bill Wilson didn't call 10 people on a board for churches and ministers in the Mayflower Hotel because he wanted to find somebody to dump his problems on. Bill Wilson actually called many, many people who thought he was crazy. He said, I'm an alcoholic. I'm looking for another alcoholic to talk to. There was no AA. He actually didn't even call Henrietta Seiberling from the lobby of the hotel. Because her name was like Melinda Gates. In his mind, she's this wealthy, wealthy woman. So he got in the elevator and he heard a voice in his head. You need to call her. And he called her from his room. And she was waiting for someone to come help Bob. And he didn't go say, Bob, sit down. I'm an alcoholic. Let me tell you about my failed business deal and my crappy life. He said, I am an alcoholic and I have a way out. And this is what it was like for me. He went to help somebody. So when we talk around here about the 10,000-pound phone, it's because you're looking at it like, I'm going to call somebody and I'm isolating. I'm going to tell them my problems. Forget all that. You know, I had a friend named Woody. And Woody tried to kill himself by walking out on the freeway. And his hospital stay coincided with my mother dying in our living room at my house I grew up in. My mother was dying slowly of cancer. And I got so tired of talking about myself and my issue and my story. Like, I was dying. My mother was dying. But I called these people that I'd heard these guys. I'd heard them. So I called Woody. And you know what Woody never did? He never asked me how I was doing. I go, how you doing? He goes, I'm screwed, man. I can't move my body. I'm never going to have sex again. I can't play tennis anymore. The guy was a champion. He beat Pete Sampras. He said, I'm ruined. I'm a broken man. And I just listened to him. And I fell in love with that guy. I sponsored him for years after that. I was not his sponsor when he was in the hospital. But you know what? It gave me strength to go be present with my mother when she was dying instead of be into the story that I am somehow a victim of an injustice because my old mother who has cancer is dying. And that's the fruits of sponsorship, right? Like if the art of living is these relationships and my problem is selfishness, you know, I'll just end with these couple of things. You know, I joke around about this, but I feel like this would be a good analogy of Alcoholics Anonymous. An alcoholic, he's lost everything, he's dying, he's in the gutter, and he gets on his knees and he says, God, I'll do anything. Yeah. I'll do anything. And God says, okay, very clearly says to him, go help other people. And the alcoholic pauses and said, is there anything else I could do? Because it seems so like anything but that, right? And I heard an analogy a long time ago about, and I hope I'm not too maudlin with this or you guys have heard it before, but I think it's beautiful and I think it's Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a phrase, well, I'll first say this. The first line in a book by Thomas Merton called No Man is an Island is Alcoholics Anonymous to me. It says, a happiness that is sought for oneself alone can never be found because a happiness that is diminished through being shared is not large enough to make a person truly happy. And I read that and thought, that's AA in one sentence, right? And the story is that this guy dies, right? And he goes and some angel meets him and says, you get into heaven, but first we're going to go to hell. And he goes, okay. So he goes down in this elevator of many, 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 many floors, and he gets out, and there's this big banquet. And there's all the food you could possibly imagine. It's a lot like being in New Orleans. There's just lots of food, some you never imagined before. And this drink and beautiful food and well laid out, and all the people at the banquet have a bar between their elbows, and they have these spoons that are just short enough that they can't reach their mouths. And they're sitting, wailing, and crying, and starving to death at this banquet all around the table. And he goes, this is hell. And he gets in the elevator and goes, let's go to heaven. And he hits the top floor, and they go miles and miles and miles. He gets out exactly the same scene, beautiful banquet. Everything you could possibly ever want, exactly the same scene. Everyone's sitting there, and they have bars between their elbows, and the spoons won't reach their mouths. And they're laughing, and they're smiling, and they're feeding each other. And that's what we have here, you know. However we carry the message, I'm being fed when I reach to you. My happiness that is never diminished by being shared is the only happiness I've ever found that's ever really made me happy. And it all comes in the inconvenient phone call. and the guy who's dying and brought it on himself. And, you know, all the lessons I've learned, all I know for sure is I don't know what's good for me, so I just say yes, and magical things happen. That's all I have to say. Thanks.
Bill, alcoholic. Liver Mike is famous in the South Bay. That guy is one of the worst drunks I've ever seen in my life. You know, and he's amazing. He's married. He's sponsoring guys. He's 6 or 7 years sober, yeah. I think, now. It's amazing he lived. And you know, what is the mechanism? How do the steps work? What's the mechanism that's used? We can read them and look at it and kind of flesh it out. It makes some logical sense. You know, you go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. I'm powerless. I need some power. I'm going to turn it over to the power. I'm going to list my life, the residue of my life. I had seeming power, and I'm left with resentments, fears, and broken relationships. I share that, you know, with someone else, finally get honest, start taking responsibility for my life. 6 and 7 are all about the character defects. You can find them in the fourth column of the inventory in the resentment list. What are my faults and mistakes? There they are. And you make amends, try to clean up the past and rid yourself of resentment. And then you live in 10, 11, and 12. And I spoke earlier, said that, you know, 1 through 9 is about 10 or 15% of the program. 10, 11, and 12 is 85, 90%. You know, they're not maintenance steps. There's nothing to maintain.
Yeah. That's right.
You know, there's nothing. We're not now going to coast. We've attained nirvana, and we're going to struggle to keep it just the way it is. You know, that isn't how life is. Not been my experience. I'm sure it hasn't been yours. Stuff happens. Things change. You change. We all change. You know, there's a lot of influences in our life all over the place. Jobs, wives, children, you know, environment, hurricanes, you know. Stuff happens, you know. In this last recession, you know, in the South Bay, probably every third guy sitting in an AA meeting is in the construction industry at some level. Real estate, framer, plumber, electrician. There was just tons of people that just lost everything. You lost their homes. People lost their homes, you know, through no fault of their own. Stuff happens to us, you know. But how do we address the character defects? What's the mechanism used? All 6 and 7 says is that we, you know, became willing and humbly asked. Doesn't say anymore. A lot of us use the 12 and 12 for 6 and 7. I personally believe that what the 12 and 12 is Bill Wilson listing all of his defects of character, you know, through the traditions and the steps. I mean, he saw a lot more at 15, 20 years sober than he did back in the day when he was 3 or 4 years sober writing the big book. He saw more. He had more experiences. Things changed. His knowledge deepened. And my belief is, my experience is the mechanism that's used to address those character defects is you. It's you. When I start working with you, when I make an attempt to reach out to you, in all my hesitation and all my concern and fear or ego-driven looking for hash-marked reasons to trying to make somebody something of myself in this anonymous world, whatever the motivation is, when I reach out to you, stuff is going to change. Things are going to come up. You've now inserted yourself, or I've inserted you into my life under the illusion that I'm teaching you something, you know. Now, that may be true at some level, but you're bringing something to the table. You, the existence of you in my life is a catalyst for change. You'll hear some people say, you know, well, I sponsor people, you know, I don't do this, I don't do that, I don't do this, I only do this, and this is what I, you know. I didn't meet those people, you know. He taught me, he says, you do it all. He used to say to me, he'd say, love fearlessly. Then he got really weird and changed it to recklessly. You know, I mean, just go out there and do it. See what happens. Nothing bad's going to happen. I mean, things are going to change. And like Matthew said, we all have these experiences. They're profound, powerful experiences. But there are experiences. They're not yours. Yes. Okay. They're ours. And we're trying to verbalize it and put it in perspective. Like when he says the light filled the room, well, there really wasn't a light. You know? I mean, something filled him up. He had an experience with this guy. Now, recently, my buddy, my oldest sponsee, Al Wooldridge, who for some odd reason called himself Floyd. You know, he's just a very strange man. And an old surfer. He's really a piece of local surfing history. He was been around South Bay for a long, long time. He was like a year or two older than me. He recently passed away at a brain tumor. It's very sad. He's been in my life almost the whole time I've been sober. And he fired me a couple of times and rehired me because nobody else would take him on, you know. I mean, he's a difficult case. And early on, his mother was dying. And they didn't have insurance. They didn't have much of anything. And he was taking care of her. His sister was there too, but she's pretty much useless. And so he was taking care of her. He was popping her hip back in the socket and changing her diapers. And he's telling me about this. You know, I mean, this was a major topic of discussion because, and he wasn't doing it with a lot of grace, but he did it. Like Matthew walking into the hospital, didn't want to be there, but he's there. I mean, you have this image of these people that are helping other people like they're this selfless spiritual entity. No, it's usually kind of kicking and screaming, you know, where you're the last one left. You know, turn out the lights when you leave the room. You know, it's like that kind of a thing. And he's doing all this. Well, she got bad enough where they took her into the hospital. And this was before cell phones, and he gave them my phone number and said, if anything happens, this is where I'll be. Call me at this number. So he comes over to my house, and he's really agitated. You know, I mean, she wasn't a very pleasant woman. She wasn't a nice lady, this woman. But it was his mother still. I mean, it was an intense experience for him. And I'm just watching this as an observer. I've never had any experience like that. I have no idea what he's really feeling. This has not happened to me yet. And so they called. And they said, you better get back here or we think she's going to pass. And so he hangs up the phone. I could tell what it was by listening. And he's standing there. He's not leaving. And I knew what he wanted. And I did not want to go. I didn't want to go there. It's not my mother. You know, I don't have any business being there. I don't have any experience at this. I mean, there's limitations to this sponsorship thing, right? You come up to a certain point and then you stop. You have to set boundaries. Don't you love that? When that started came in, man, that just, you know what boundaries are to me? You know, somebody here might be into the whole boundary thing, and I'm sorry if I'm insulting you. But what it is to me, there's something I don't like, so I'm going to keep it out there so I don't have to deal with it. That's us. Why would I ever consciously put myself in an uncomfortable position? This was way uncomfortable, and I did not want to go. And he just stood there. He didn't leave. Finally, I said to him, do you want me to go with you? And he said, would you please? So I went. Walked in the room. It was awful. She looked awful. It smelled awful. She was hooked up to all the monitors. They were breathing for her. Sounds are going off. I'm kind of freaked out. He's really agitated. He's a big guy like me, big carpenter, big old hands. And I found a chair over in the corner, and I went and I sat down just to almost try to eliminate myself from the situation. And I closed my eyes, and I probably mumbled something like, help me, please. You know, it's like, I'm sure, because given motivation, even with my bad attitude, I will ultimately ask for help. You know, because there's nothing left to do. He's told me for years, Bill, you will be reduced to prayer and meditation. Meaning you won't skippingly run into it, you know. You know, that there'll be nothing left to do. Nothing else will work. And this feeling came over me. And the feeling was, everything's okay. There's nothing wrong here. This is not a mistake. It's all right. And I relaxed. He's pacing the floor. There's another chair next to me. I said, Al, come over here and sit down. He comes and he sits down next to me. And I held his hand, his big old hand, and I said, let's say a prayer. And we said some prayer. I don't remember what I said. I said it, but I said something. And while we were praying, I could feel his hand relax in my hand. That's intimacy. That's what it is. That's intimacy. It's very quiet, very subtle. And we rarely run into it. If we pick and choose what we will and won't do, we'll miss it. This is what causes change in us. I will never forget that. He used to go with me all the time when I started speaking. And I would tell that story, and he'd be sitting there. Finally, one day, and he never commented on it. He never said a word. I said, do you remember that in the hospital? He goes, I remember you were there. I said, do you remember the prayer? He goes, no, I don't remember any of that. It was my experience. It wasn't his experience. It was my experience. When he was dying recently, he looked at me before he stopped talking, and he said, you've always been a stand-up guy. And I looked at him and I said, so have you. He took care of his mother. He was a good man. And I saw that in him through all the weirdness, through all of his quirky little things, because he grew up in such a weird family. You know, this was a good man. This guy came over to my house one time to read the book. I really liked this guy. And he came over to read the book, and I have an office downstairs in a room down below at my house. And he's sitting across the table from me on the couch, and I'm sitting in my chair. And he had his book open, I think, if I remember correctly. And what happened is I'm looking at him, and I just went out. I closed my eyes, my head kind of fell back, and I just went out. I just took a little vacation, you know. You know, like something happened, and I remember being in that state. I'm not sure how long it lasted, but I remember being there, and it was just comfortable. Nothing, I wasn't seeing anything. I just kind of relaxed into the room, and somehow I connected with this guy. There was a connection there. And he, fortunately, just stayed quiet. He's a pretty spiritual guy. He had his own little spiritual practice, and he was just quiet. And he told me later, he says, I just was watching you, man. I wonder what's going to happen next. You know? And then I kind of came out of it. Neither one of us spoke about it, and we just read the book. Sometime later, I asked him about that. You remember that? And he goes, yeah. And I said, well, did you get the same thing? He's, no, man, that was you. You know, that was yours. And he knew what it was. He knew. He got it. But it wasn't his. It was mine. On another occasion, I went on this 12-step call. It was Memorial Day weekend. And I took my friend Derek with me. The central office called and said, you know, there's a 12-step call in this motel, in this hotel. So we drive there. I go get Derek. We drive there. We said something like, we have a half a pack of cigarettes and a quarter tank of gas. We're on a mission from God. You know, we were like 3 years sober, man. I was on fire. I was doing like a lot of 12-step calls. And I really felt that I was bulletproof and that, you know, the Lord had given me this ability to save souls, and I'm out there, man. You know, it was embarrassing, but God damn, it was fun. And so we go to this place, and it's like a war zone, man. There's barbed wire on top of the fences. Not a good part of town. And there's guys out in the street drinking beer. There's a trash can with a fire burning in it out front. It was like out of a Clint Eastwood movie, you know, Dirty Harry. And I we pull up, and Derek goes, "We got to just leave. This does not look good, you know." And I go, "Oh, we can't leave. We got to go do this, you know." And I'm scared. You know, remember, I'm the phony biker. I'm the phony tough guy, man. You know, so we get up, we walk into this hotel, and it smelled horrible in this place. And this weird, creepy little guy comes to the window. I swear to God, this is absolute God's truth. And I looked at the guy, and I said, "You know, we're from Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody called, you know, looking for help, and we're here to get them." You know, and the guy goes, "Well, I don't know who called." He says, "You're welcome to go bang on doors down the hallway if you want." So I go walk over to the hallway, and I look down, and all these doors have like hasps over them with a padlock on the outside. You know, I mean, I don't remember that there were even numbers on the doors. You know, and I'm thinking, and Derek is behind me just shaking like a leaf, man. He's scared to death. So am I, but I'm trying to be cool. And I'm standing at the head of this thing, and I closed my eyes, and I said, "You got to help me now. You know, I need help. I'm scared to death, and you got to help me." And the fear just went away. It just went away. Now, I have no explanation for that. I don't know what that was about. And I remember I just walked down the hallway, and I was just banging on doors, you know. And we didn't find anybody. So we get back and we go in the car, and not far from where we were is this place that used to be around there called the Way Back Inn. And I figured, you know, if somebody, you know, I went back to the window and I asked the guy, I said, "You know, we can't find," he says, "You know, there were two other guys here earlier, and they took some guy with them." And I go, "Sons of bitches stole my 12-step call." You know, it pissed me off, you know. And I jumped in the car, and I go to the Way Back Inn, and I said, "Did you just guy do an intake on some?" "Yeah, we got him." So I called central office, and I said, "How come you called somebody else?" "And, well, we weren't sure that you would go." And I, "God damn it." You know, that was my experience. I had that experience. I wouldn't have had that experience if I didn't go, if I didn't put myself in an uncomfortable position. I didn't know what was going to happen. That's why we don't want to do it, because we're not in control. We're not in charge. We're somewhere where we don't know how to talk or how to be. We don't know the people around us, and we don't like that situation. It's uncomfortable. That's when change happens. You know, he called me one night, and he says, "God is drunk in Wilmington, and he needs us." Now, I've taken a lot of acid. No one has ever said anything that weird to me. You know? And he comes over, picks me up. He's giggling like a schoolgirl. I'm scared to death, right? You know, I'm the new guy. And we go down there, and we picked up Jesus and took him to the Alano Club. He was drunk. You know? My friend Patrick Keelahan died. Jay was with him when he died. Sat with him. And my friend had an 8-year-old son that died from leukemia. I walked in that hospital room when he was dying, and it freaked me out. He was the same age as my young kids. Freaked me out, and I called Jay, and I said, "I can't go back in there." And Jay didn't even know this guy. He was a friend of mine in AA. Jay didn't know him. I said, "I can't go back in there." And Jay says, "I'll go with you." So the next night, we went down and walked in there together, you know. I was still freaked out, but I had support. You know, there were AA people that were in the lobby that could not walk in that room. It was just too awful.
And we went there together every other day for 6 months.
For a long time. So that the dad could yell at us and he wouldn't yell at the doctors. You know. And so when my dad came to me and said, "I've got cancer, and I'm not going to do the chemotherapy," I was ready. I was ready. I wasn't freaked out. I wasn't frightened. I didn't want to lose my father, but I knew what the face of death looked like. I knew what fear felt like. I knew that it wouldn't kill me. Whatever happened wouldn't kill me. I'm not drinking, I'm not medicated, and I don't need medication. You know, I've grown up now. I've grown up. This is my job. I had a guy not long after that, he calls me up and he goes, my father's dying. I don't think I'm going to make it through this. And I said, wait a minute. Isn't it your dad that's dying? And there was this quiet silence on the phone. He went, oh, shit. You know, because we make it about ourselves, don't we? This is hard on me. No, it's not. It was hard on my dad. You know, I was there to comfort and love and care for him, the man that raised me. And he passed away. My mother came and lived with us, and then I nursed my mother when she got cancer at 85 years old. She died in the living room of my house. Jay would come walking up the walk, and I go, oh, Mom, here comes Jay. And she goes, shit, we're going to have to pray again. You know? You know, he'd come in, Jay would pray, we'd all pray, you know. And she was an Al-Anon. The Al-Anons are great because they show up, they bring food. You know, and they're willing to clean, do laundry, anything. You can get those women to do anything, you know. But I took care of my mom, and I changed her diapers, you know, and she thought she'd lost her dignity. And you know what she said to me? She said, I never raised you to do this. And I thought about that, and I said, oh, yes, you did. Because I grew up in that AA house, and I told her, I said, I know what you were doing now. You were saving those people's lives. Yes, you raised me to do this. I grew up in AA. I grew up. I'm not a wimp anymore. I'm not a frightened little boy. I don't have to cover up my fear with anger anymore. You know, life is real. I can take responsibility for my life. I've grown up. Completely? Not entirely. But it's a lot better than it was. You know? So I'll tell you something, just in closing here. I don't know that I'm going to have an experience over here that's going to affect something that happens to me clear over here 10 years later. I can't figure that out. I don't know which ones I should have and shouldn't have. Now, I think I want to make decisions about what I will and won't do. This has shown me I don't have a clue. I just need to go with the flow. So I try really diligently to live by two rules. Always answer the phone. Get rid of caller ID. Have faith that whoever's calling you is supposed to be in your life or they wouldn't be calling. That's how people and how God gets a hold of us. Number two, whatever they ask you to do, do it. Don't question it. Sometimes you end up in New Orleans eating gumbo. It's cool. You know? Sometimes you end up in Hawaii leading a retreat. Really cool, you know. And then sometimes you end up in Lompoc or some
Lloydminster
in the winter, you know, or some Fargo, North Dakota is a real hot spot, you know. But you know, people, how do you get to do lead retreats in Hawaii? You got to go to Fargo.
You know, 10 times.
Yeah, 10 times. You know, so that's all I have. Thank you.
The holiest place in the world that I've experienced so far is being in the room when somebody appears to be born. The second most holy place that I've been is being in a room where someone appears to die, although I don't believe in that anymore, when they pass beyond our sight and hearing. But the third holiest place there is at the kitchen table, turning pages. When you sit there and you see someone that was hopeless, go, oh, I can do this. Or, oh my God, this is me. Or, oh, you can't believe what happened. We have the ability to do something that no one else can do, which is raise the dead. And every person in here, there is one life that you are designed to save. I stole that from his father. That you're designed to save, because I'll just piss him off. And you have a particular experience in this life that is valuable beyond measure. How do I know that? Because I've been doing this for 36 years. And there's nothing special about me. The only thing that's special about my recovery is that I've never gone on hiatus. I've always had a sponsor, and I've always sponsored. And that when I go to the room, I am never, I always tell the people that I sponsor, don't you ever think that you're going to talk to me at the meeting. Because when I go to the meeting, the first thing I do is I scan the room for somebody I don't know. Scan the parking lot for somebody I don't know. And I walk up to them. And I say, hi, I'm Jay. I haven't had the privilege of meeting you here before. I come here regularly. Do you have a seat? When I got sober in 1979, in the first 6 months, I heard all the great speakers. I heard all the classic rock XA speakers, okay? And I can't tell you a word they said, maybe a couple words. But I remember everybody that was kind to me the first few weeks. It's the kindness. If you want to sponsor people, all you have to do is be kind. Look them in the eye. So what are the fruits of sponsorship? I've been literally at it for almost 36 years. I mean, 31 years tomorrow just with one guy. It's the longest, this is the longest relationship either of us have ever had.
It's kind fairly of sad.
Pathetic.
Huh?
In the doctor's opinion, Silkworth talks about that with our ultra-modern methods, that we sometimes do not rely upon the forces of good which lie beyond our synthetic knowledge. That's the line. Mm-hmm. This is the forces of good that lie beyond synthetic knowledge. This is where we play. We don't play in the synthetic realm. We don't play in the third dimension. We play in the fourth and get to visit the fifth. And that's a reason for coming back. So what happens? All kinds of wonderful stuff happens. For example, you get phone calls. Now, we talked about going to the hospital when the child's dying. I get a call from Timmy Bannis. He says, get down here. It's happening. What's happening? Well, the baby's being born. So get in the car, run down there. Now, my wife and I had been trying to get pregnant at that time. We'd been trying to get pregnant for about 4 or 5 months. She was starting to get nervous. I was having a little bit too much fun. You know, these things happen. Anyway, so I go down to the hospital. Now, I, being a male, I'd never been invited into the room before. And I literally was invited into the room probably within an hour after Danny came into this world. The light was still throbbing in the room when I walked in. Because I'm awake. I can feel it. I can see it. And I got to hold this baby. And I knew that there was no way without sobriety that this man that I sponsored and his wife would ever have had this child. And I walk out into the parking lot after this, just overwhelmed. And I look up in the sky, and I say, "Big guy, if it's your will, I'd really like to have that experience." And that was the night my daughter was conceived. I'm awake. I remember things. I remember the prayers. I remember the feelings. I remember where I've been and who I was talking to. Another great experience for me was we talk about, sometimes we call this talk the death card, because we're all talking about, you know, all this, you know, hospitals and all that stuff. But there's a wonderful theologian by the name of Henry Nouwen, and he said, "The reason that we love fearlessly is that every time that our heart is broken, it is broken open. And then we have more to share with others." And this is what we're called to do in the fellowships. We are called to love fearlessly. I was at the South Bay Roundup. There's this weirdo that shows up. I get a phone call from him. He wants to talk about AA history a little bit. And okay, you know, come by the roundup, and I'll carve out an hour for you, and we'll talk. And I happen to have some of my research books there. And he was living in the Netherlands, and I gave him some books, and he asked me to sponsor him. Now, he intended to ask Bill to sponsor him, but he made a mistake and asked me. Now, the great thing about that is that he and Bill were able to have an abiding friendship, which when you're somebody's sponsor, you don't have, because it's a different deal. Many times, one of the difficulties is that people make a father out of you, and they've never had a good relationship with their father. So it's not a real easy relationship. And when we're asked to sponsor somebody, we're asked to love them in a different dimension. This is how we enter the fourth dimension. Because this has nothing to do with family. This has nothing to do with any recompense. This only has to do with love in its purest form. And we get to do that here. So this guy, we end up working together and all this stuff, and we end up, that's how we got to Northern Europe. And he helped found Cocaine Anonymous there, and we start going over. And the first time we go over, the big deal was, people wanted to know about working the steps and sponsoring people. And so we go and do that. We have an incredible experience. 3 years later, we go back, and they want to know about the traditions, because they're sober and they're having the same problems that the first people were having. And so we get to work with them on the traditions. Unbelievable. Then they start getting it. They find they have problems other than alcohol. And they start founding fellowships and carrying the message to people that have entirely different problems. There was a kid from Gamers Anonymous. You know, all this. Okay. And what happened is that we got to be there and be present and watch this fellowship flower around a man who probably had as difficult a story as many people could have. He had been involved in some heinous behaviors. And yet, through his commitment to this way of life, that my whatever small contribution I made and a lot of Bill's friendship, he really touched a lot of people. His partner was the person that was the founder of Cocaine Anonymous in the Netherlands. I mean, impacted an entire nation. And we had the privilege of witnessing that.
Yeah.
And we had nothing to do with it. Nothing. We just showed up, took the calls, you know, occasionally, but we were there spiritually, and we were able to be of service to this guy. And this guy, you want to talk about self-centered. He would, like, do things like make sure that I was in the Netherlands when I turned 30 years sober. And he had a party. And there were people with, there were like six generations of these little fun-loving criminals that all looked at me like I had something. But yet we were able to give them a sense of purpose and unity and recovery and success. And he was a very special case. My wife Adele, who is sober 26 years, we say nobody ever crosses our threshold that's a mild case. And this friend of ours decided that that when he got sick, that he was going to step off consciously, because you can do that in the Netherlands. And so this man gave us a gift that I'd never ever dreamed that was possible, which was to be present when the person goes from this room into the next, and not have all that emotion that goes on around about, oh, get everybody together now, or do this or that. I mean, we were able to all be there loving him as he took his light into the next room, and there wasn't the drama that normally happens. And it was one of the most profound experiences that I've had. When I was looking for wife version 2.0, I put together a little list of what I was looking for. And the very first thing, because sponsorship is the most important thing in my life, was I wanted a woman that had a sponsor and that sponsored people. And my wife has had some tremendous challenges. She's had 8 strokes, open heart surgery, had all kinds of different neurological problems and challenges, and I have watched how her sponsees saved her life just by calling. And for that 1 minute, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, taken her mind off of herself and her problems. There is nothing about sponsorship. There's no downside to it. There's none. The only downside to it is the illusion of self. The illusion that I know what it is that I need to do or want to do or have to do at any given moment. Now, does that mean that when I answer the phone and the guy calls me and I'm in New Orleans and I'm with you guys, that I drop everything that I'm doing to attend to his needs? No. But I'm there. I pick the phone up. I say hello. I say I'll be back on Monday. We can talk then. It's only the illusion of self. And this is what we're called to do, is to become selfless. It is the best ride in the world. And we get to do it for fun and for free. Thanks.
Just a quick little story about he was dying. We were on Skype. I was supposed to fly over there, but I got sick and I couldn't make it. So he had me on Skype. So he came and talked to me for a little bit. He was totally relaxed, and he had 2 or 3 of his sponsees around and his lady Monica. And the doctor showed up. The doctor was really cool, and he had a nurse, And so we talked a little bit, and he went and laid down on the bed. And the first thing they do is they inject you with some pain medication, pain to knock you out, and then they give you the juice. So here this guy is. He's sober a long time. He's kind of an old curmudgeon. And he had leukemia. You know, I mean, he was gone. It was, you know, and he's laying there on the bed. And our friend used to always say in his talk, would talk about how when you're going under anesthetic that he loved 98, 100, 99, 98, you know. And it was always funny. So the last thing that said, he's laying on the bed, and he goes, 98, right to the end, man. It was like, it was one of the sweetest things I've ever experienced. It was, and I miss him dearly. He was a dear friend. Can we take a break?
Sure.